Today, our show explores what happens at McGill when you go on strike for Palestine. 19 undergraduate departments voted to strike during the week of November 17th to 21st, but many professors chose not to cancel class, leading protesters to stage soft pickets and classroom disruptions, and leading McGill security to intervene.
We are asking you to move to another location.
Why are you allowed to follow us off campus onto Prince Arthur and Du Rocher? It's a very simple question.
The professor has given us permission.
Asking you.
For on whose orders?
On whose orders?
You're hurting me. You're not letting me move my leg. It's in the door.
This is only
gonna
go online.
You're not letting me move my fucking leg.
Just
this
is only gonna go online.
It hurt.
They did not do anything in my comms class. They were very calm.
Last warning.
Don't touch me! Please do not touch me! This is totally inappropriate!
This isn't the first student strike for Palestine. The Undergraduate Student Society approved two other strikes earlier this year. But this time, McGill took a different tack against picketers, handing out papers banning students from campus at demonstrations. Now, those papers are impossible to enforce, but that's not the case for a smaller group of picketers who were served these papers by name and are now navigating what's possible when your university doesn't want you there. One of those students is Cecilia Callahan, who stopped by the station last Thursday. We talk about the strikes, their aftermath, and the many questions left about how McGill identified these masked picketers in the first place. Here's our conversation.
Thanks for coming on CKUT. Can I just ask you to introduce yourself?
Yeah, so my name's Cecilia. I'm a U2 student here at McGill. I'm studying GSFS and philosophy.
And GSFS, for our listeners who don't know.
Oh, yes, sorry. It's gender, sexuality, feminist, and social justice studies, so it's a bit of a mouthful.
And you're not just studying it, you are the president, right?
Yes, for GSFS, I am, like, the president. I mean, technically we're non-hierarchical, but for, like, student union terms, I am the president, yes.
And we're speaking today because you took part in student strikes that happened last week on McGill campus for Palestine. But the fallout from that week of strikes is we now have you and I believe three other students who have been banned from campus. Am I getting that number right?
There's three of us in total who are actually students. Somebody else received one of these charges, but and with their name and everything, but they graduated. So it's a little bit funny to me that McGill can, like, track our identity so well, but then not even check if somebody's still going here. But and then other people received orders, but were not identified. So
yeah. So what happened there? So you are, you know, one of the people taking part in these strikes. It sounds like not just one of the people taking part, but an organizer within your department. And you get slapped with this order to exclude from McGill. And that says, basically, we don't want you on campus for the next 15 working days. How did you get to this point first? What actually happened on the day?
Yeah, so it was on Wednesday that I received this order, but we first saw this order on Monday on the first day of strikes. We were picketing a philosophy course, and the security guards actually came up to my friend who was the first to receive one of these exclusion orders, and this friend was, like, masked up. They had a keffiyeh wrapped around their head, but the security guard came right up to them and called them by their name, and which was really scary for this person. Obviously, nobody wants to know that McGill security knows their full name, and said, like, this is your first warning, whatever. And then a bit later on, my friend received this exclusion order from McGill, signed off by Dean Shapiro, who's, like, the head of the art students. So, like, we saw the first of these exclusion orders on the first day, and we'd never seen any of these before. Like, in the SMU strikes on October 7th or last year in April, these had never been given out. It's a new addition to the new student code of conduct that I think was approved in Senate on November 12th, if I'm remembering correctly.
I'm gonna interrupt you because this is an order, so, like, they're giving you these orders generally, right? So your friend on Monday, they got something, a piece of paper that said, what, dear student, basically, you're not allowed back on campus for X and Y reasons. Did they get something by name, or was it still general at that point?
It was by name. The general orders didn't come until later in the week.
We'll speak a little bit more in a bit about what exactly was happening that week, but just so listeners have an idea, this is a piece of paper that is signed by Lisa Shapiro, who's the dean of the Faculty of Arts at McGill. And a typical order would read, "Dear student, in accordance with Article 29D of the Code of Student Conduct and Disciplinary Procedures, and based on reasonable grounds of concern for good order and safety of others, I'm excluding you from McGill premises for a period of 15 working days." It later says that's not a disciplinary measure, but it's an immediate safety measure to uphold the health and safety of the community. And my first question to you is, what were you guys doing that was violating the health and safety of the community in that week of strikes?
Yeah, so in my opinion, we weren't violating the self and safety of the community, but we were soft picketing. So this is like what was approved in all the motions of the departments. There was two departments that did vote for a hard picket, but technically that's like not allowed in the new student code of conduct. It doesn't say that anywhere specifically that you're not allowed to hard picket, but it has to do with obstruction. So whatever, those motions were changed.
Yeah. And what's the difference for people who aren't familiar?
So a hard picket is when entrances to like meeting rooms, classrooms, whatever it is that you're picketing are physically blocked. And so that could be like with your bodies or with a table or with a chair. It's just anything to like physically prevent people from breaking a picket line. Whereas a soft picket is disruption for the purpose of discouraging people from scabbing and breaking the picket line. So there's no physical blockage, but it can look like giving speeches, talking to people, handing out flyers, making noise, like banging on drums, playing music. The goal is just like to disrupt and raise conscious to the point that people will not want to break that picket line and go to class.
And you say break the picket line, but from what I understand, it was the student, you know, department associations held these general assemblies when there was a positive vote to do this strike, when it was approved. Basically, what you guys sent out something to the profs and the students saying, like, don't hold class. But then what I've heard is a lot of people did hold class. And mm-hmm. so students were like, well, okay, this is my midterm review. This is my, you know, these are the notes on how I have to write my final paper. Like, I'm going to go to class because what the students voted isn't necessarily changing my prof's mind. Did that factor into your thinking about how to do these disruptions and you know, the point of it all, I guess?
Yeah. I mean, we knew that professors, at least most professors, would not be canceling their lectures. They rarely do. We've seen this in the past because, of course, like a student association is not enforcing on professors. That's completely different. But the idea being, if your student association votes for a strike, it's a strike, it's not a boycott. So it is like enforcing on all membership in the student association, and you are therefore on strike and should not go to class. And if nobody goes to class, then the professor cannot continue their lectures as usual and need to accommodate for that. But we did, like, a lot of student associations did email professors and ask them to cancel class because professors are sympathetic to our cause and they, for the most part, stand with us. I mean, that varies, of course. But we also knew that professors wouldn't cancel class, not just for this reason that, like, you know, of course, the student association's vote isn't enforcing on them, but also there's a lot of communication from administration to professors with every strike saying you cannot cancel your classes for this reason. I was talking to one professor I have who's a GSFS and philosophy professor, and she was saying that the dean of arts was emailing professors and saying, like, you are literally not allowed to do this, which my professor was saying is not accurate, because actually professors can cancel classes whenever they want for any reason. There's like a limit to it and a limit to how many classes you can hold on Zoom. I think that's 20%. But the point being, from this professor's perspective and from my own, there's a little bit of misinformation being given to professors of what their rights are. But yeah, besides the point, we know that if students respect the strike decision and don't go to class, the strike is therefore enforced and professors cannot hold class as usual. So that's what we were doing. We were in classes making speeches, talking to students. We'd often open up the floor for conversations to happen, ask if they have any questions, because we understand that it can be confusing sometimes. But also we were doing chants every now and then. We'd bring in a speaker and play music Because, you know, the point of protest is disruption and awareness building and making it clear that, like, business as usual will not continue during genocide. And that's our goal. That was our goals with the soft picket. And to our understanding as students and as, for a lot of us, people that had participated in pickets before, everything we were doing are within our rights as people here in Canada, but also as students of McGill University.
You said people are going into classrooms. Like, how long are you staying there? What's exactly happening? Because you say, okay, we're not actually doing hard pickets. We're not blocking any classrooms. Like, as far as you know, that didn't happen.
It happened at one class because I know the Sociology Students Association voted for a hard picket in their motion. But also, for the most part, we didn't hard picket sociology classes because we received communication that hard pickets just aren't allowed, even if it was voted on. But there was one class that was hard picketed. Nobody even received one of these exclusion orders from that, though. So the exclusion orders were not related to that picket, yeah.
So then you're mostly, like, outside with banners, chanting, things like that, trying to say, don't go, don't scab. Then going into classrooms, like, how long are these disruptions taking? I heard that some classes were just stopped. They were canceled. Everybody had to leave. Is that kind of typical?
It was so dependent, and it's also, like, based on every faculty, sometimes you can really see a difference, whereas, I don't know, some students are maybe more sympathetic to our cause and others aren't, but typically, yeah, we would go in, we'd give, like, a long speech informing everybody what's going on, and then we'd open the floor to discussions, and then it kind of depended a lot on, like, how sympathetic professors and students were as to how long we stayed in there and how long we didn't. Also, sometimes...
Yeah, what does that mean? Like, if they were sympathetic and were like, okay, well, class is done now, you guys would leave? Or if they were unsympathetic and said, get the heck out of here, then you would leave?
I don't know. There was so many, like, different reactions to us. There was... I can think of one big lecture in Leacock 132, which, like, for anybody that's been at McGill, it's the huge auditorium in Leacock. And we kind of went into it saying, like, we are going to enforce this strike, like, because it is such a big class and we have the chance to have a big impact here. And so those professors were very mad at us and were telling us, and we were giving just a speech. We didn't even have, like, noisemakers or speakers or anything, giving a speech and opening the floor to discussion. And the professors, there was two of them, were getting very, very mad at us and trying to tell us we have to leave and that this was a hard picket, which is something we encountered a lot throughout the week, where students and professors were telling us that what we were doing was hard picketing when it was not, which I think just really speaks to our whole goal with these strikes and why it was so important that we weren't just striking to ask for divestment, but raising awareness of our rights as students and that we are allowed to strike at McGill and what a strike does. Because it was honestly just really sad to me to see that this, like, professor who's probably been teaching in Quebec for years now doesn't even understand the difference between a soft and a hard picket, especially because Quebec does have such a history of striking. We stayed in that class until, like, there was 10 minutes left, I believe, so we effectively shut it down. Sometimes professors would be like, okay, there's a picket line, I will never cross a picket line, so class is canceled. Sometimes security would, like, towards the end of the week, Thursday specifically, security was carrying people out of classrooms. There was one situation where, like, a girl was picked up by all four limbs and the class hadn't even begun. She'd come in to make an announcement beforehand. Yeah, I don't know. I hope that answered your question. It was all so different. And a lot of the time, like, how long we stayed, depending on if students were walking out without us having to stay, if security was coming in and forcing us out, or, like, just how hostile students... Because it is also hard to stay in a situation where you're trying to talk to people about genocide and students are laughing at you. It's sometimes it can be just, like, too much of a morale downer that you kind of have to get out of there.
I think why we're here is not just because of the strike, but because of McGill and McGill security and their reaction to the strike. So you spoke already about an exclusion order, right, that a friend of yours got on Monday, the first day of the strike. But by the end of the week, you said four people had specifically by name received these orders from McGill. I want to talk about these orders a little bit. So you said McGill has passed a new code of conduct for students earlier this month. November 12th is the date. And if you go to the non-academic offenses section of this code of conduct. Number 11 is obstruction. No students shall obstruct university activities, including but not limited to teaching and learning. So this already seems like, okay, you guys are, you're getting flagged under this new code. But then if you scroll down, 29 is what you guys are really getting dinged under, which is orders and sanctions. And this is what's called an interim order, right? So it's not a disciplinary process that's been started against you and other picketers, but it is a tool that McGill can use to say, you're going to be off campus, you can't come back. And how they justify, it's called an order to exclude. And they say, and I quote, where a student's conduct gives rise to reasonable grounds to believe that the student's continued presence constitutes a serious physical or psychological threat to the well-being of themselves or others, and when the threat cannot be alleviated or remedied by less severe means. That's the criteria. Mm-hmm. Did McGill tell you, when they're handing you this order, did they say, these are the threats? Did they try other means? When we're looking at the actual criteria there, how was McGill trying to meet them?
Yeah, I mean, I guess they could argue that the secure, like, all throughout the week, the security were just telling us we're not allowed to protest, essentially. But that's just not true. Like, the student code of conduct also says, like, every group of students has a right to organize and promote the interests of its members and, like, can hold, like, lawful demonstrations. So it's, in our view, everything we're doing within our right was in our right. Security was trying to shut us down. But the psychological or physical threat, they never said how I was a psychological or physical threat when they read it out to me. All they did when I was, so this was like, when I received my exclusion order, it was on Wednesday, and I had just given, just myself and one other person had gone into Adams Auditorium, another big auditorium, and I'd just done an announcement, and I explicitly said, you know, you guys are on strike, you're breaking a picket line right now, this is why we're on strike, I'm not going to disrupt this class, the professor can continue lecturing if they choose, but I'm just going to flyer. And so I handed everybody flyers and told them that there's alternative programming that they could go to. And then the security, like, issued their first warning, but the warnings are also different than the exclusion orders. They would give us these warnings all week, and it was like, you are being too noisy, so that regular business cannot continue, which...
You're obstructing, basically.
Yeah, yeah. But again, like, I wasn't speaking at that time. I was flyering. Like, they'll say these things that just don't match up. Anyways, and then me and my friend left that classroom, and these, like, 15 security guards were just following us around campus. Actually went to the bathroom, and they were standing outside the door. And then we were leaving campus, and they read out just the exclusion order to me. They didn't state how I fell under any of the criteria in the exclusion order. They just read it out, and they said, this will apply to you if and when we identify you. And then 3 hours later, I was stayed off campus that whole time. And then 3 hours later, I got an email that had identified me saying, like, dear Miss Callahan, and then the exclusion order. And so also, not only was McGill security on us the whole time, but people with camcorders, and I believe that's how they identified me, because as I was, like, pretty well, like, blocked up, like, my face was covered, I had sunglasses on and a mask the whole time I was protesting to protect my identity. But as I was walking off campus, and after they'd read me the order and said, if and when we identify you, they were yelling at these people with camcorders to, like, get close-ups of my eyes. So I believe, like, how AI surveillance usually works is they can identify people's faces by their eyebrows. So I believe they probably, in those 3 hours that I wasn't on campus, so they couldn't have seen any more of me, they probably were running that through some sort of, like, identity detector.
So you think, yeah, that McGill is using facial recognition software, basically?
Yeah. I don't see how else they would have known who I was.
I do want to state for listeners, you have bleached hair, bleached eyebrows, and each eyebrow has an eyebrow piercing. So you are a distinctive-looking, yeah, person. If they got the eyebrows, it would be a pretty easy ID if they had something to compare it to.
But I don't know. Like, I mean, a lot of people, we are in Montreal, a lot of people have these eyebrow piercings, like, and I do believe if it was just my, like, look, they could have identified me instantly. I don't know. And my other friends that were ID'd all have, like, brown eyebrows and no piercings. Yeah, no piercing. I don't know.
this is like a fairly serious accusation at McGill, that they're using facial recognition. They're filming their students, then they're running them through facial recognition without telling anybody that they're using these tools, and then using that to bar students from entering campus. I spoke to one of the other protesters who, for obvious reasons, has asked to remain anonymous, who said, well, I think they got me because I swiped my ID card to let everybody in when we went to picket a building. That's how they think that they were ID'd. Yeah. You didn't do anything like that.
Yeah, I believe because that was on the last day that they swiped it when McGill required ID to enter buildings. I imagine that for sure is why they were identified. I never swiped my ID, also because I'd been banned by the time that they were requiring that. So I never swiped my ID. And these people with camcorders have never been at the other protests. What I heard people saying was that they believe that it is Serco, which is a outside surveillance firm. I have not received confirmation of this. And I asked Dean Shapiro, who signed off on my exclusion order in the Arts Undergraduate Society had a president's roundtable the other day. And I asked her, I said, how are you identifying these people that you're giving exclusion orders? Are you using Serco? Because I heard that, but could you confirm? And she said she has no idea if they're using Serco. She doesn't know who they hire, and she doesn't know how they're identified. She just trusts the orders that she gets.
Yeah, and Serco is a private security firm that McGill used in the past, for instance, to help with the dismantling of the encampment, the pro-Palestine encampment that was on McGill's lower field. And they typically use Garda World, is that right?
For security, yeah.
So Serco would be an additional force that's coming in, hired by McGill for this specific purpose. But again, we have to fact check that.
Yeah, I know that for sure they used Garda World this time because the Garda World security have to, they actually wear vests and hats that say Garda World. But these people at the camcorders were not wearing any sort of identifiable security gear the first few days. And then I actually talked to one of the security guards from Garda World, and I said, who are these people at the camcorders? Are they with you? And he said, yes, they're part of, they're with us. You don't have to worry. And I was like, well, can they please wear some sort of identifying jacket? Because it's very scary to have. And professors were also very upset with these people coming in their classes. But so then the day after I complained, I think Wednesday, they started wearing just those bright orange security vests. But it still didn't say, my point being that we know that it was Garda World that was doing the security because it says that on their jackets. But these people at the camcorders didn't have any sort of company identified on them. So we can't know if it was Serco or not.
And you've referred to Dean Shapiro. This is Lisa Shapiro, a philosophy professor at McGill, who's the dean in arts. You're asking, where did you get your orders from? For people who don't necessarily understand that, because this is the person who's signing off on these orders to exclude, at least within the Faculty of Arts. I'm going to go back to the Code of Conduct, which I apologize. It's not the most easy document to read. But it says the disciplinary officer must, pursuant to consultation with the dean of students, exclude the student from part or all of the university premises if this threshold that we've talked about earlier is met. And so basically in this case, the dean of students is all students, and the disciplinary officer, the dean of arts is acting as the disciplinary officer in your case, although there's specific people in arts who have that role. I want to talk about that language, right? Because it says must exclude.
Mm-hmm.
And you said, this is a new provision that's introduced in this latest code of conduct. It's actually not. So the order to exclude has been around for the past 10 years, at least, at McGill.
Mm-hmm.
It used to be a 5-day order, and it used to be a tool that could be used, but wasn't necessarily. So the language was, you may exclude a student. And it was 5 days. In 2019, that changed to 10 days. And these orders were mostly used during COVID for if students in residence broke the rules. Then it was saying okay, if you're breaking our COVID regulations, we can slap these 10-day bans on you. Now it seems with this latest code, that has changed from a tool that can possibly be used. And now the disciplinary officer, in this case, their hands are tied. If there's an order coming down from the dean of students saying this person is a threat, they have to use it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just 5 days. It's not just 10 days. Within the last year, it's ballooned to 15 days now. And why this is significant, right, is because we talked about, there's other parts in the, I know this is like quite bureaucratic and granular and probably not that interesting, but there's other parts in the code where they say like, okay, this is an infraction, right? If you were obstructing, that's an infraction. Mm-hmm. And they could bring a case against you. They could do that, McGill. They could say you are obstructing, but they haven't done that yet. No. They've just given you a ban. And as far as I understand it, there's no clear way for you to fight that. It's at their discretion, and there's no process for you to appeal. Is that tell me what you have heard about this.
That is my understanding as well. That was my understanding from reading my exclusion order and being in contact with both Dean Shapiro and Mittenmeier. However, I need to go to the legal aid at McGill, and I just haven't had the chance yet. But my friend who also received this order, who decided to remain anonymous, said that they were told by the legal aid at McGill that they are still supposed to have an interview with the dean of students regarding this exclusion order. But that's just information that they got from legal aid. None of these people, the disciplinary officers or the dean of students, have told that to us, and I can't confirm that an interview needs to be taking place because I was not told that by legal aid. So, yeah, to my understanding, there's no, like, process for me.
Yeah,
right now.
And what has been your, you know, conversations with McGill, whether that is Lisa Shapiro, whether that is Dean Mittenmeier, Dean of Students, apart from what you've already said at this AUS, that's the Arts Undergraduate Society meeting, what kind of interactions, what kind of exchanges have you had?
Yeah, so I got my exclusion order, like I said, on Wednesday of last week, and then I asked Dean Shapiro if I was allowed to go to classes under this exclusion, and she said that she can't, like, tell me that. That falls under the Dean of Students, which confused me because she signed off on it. And then I asked, Mittenmeier said, like, I need to send him my agenda and my exam schedule, and I'm only allowed on campus for those purposes, and that he would alert security when I am on campus for my classes.
Okay, so it's a ban, but it's not a full ban. You can come to your classes, you can go to your exams, but you can't be on campus otherwise.
Yeah, correct. And I was in contact with Dean Shapiro just in, like, ahead of this Arts Undergraduate Society President's meeting to ask if I could come to this meeting because she specifically called it to talk about these strikes, and I obviously had concerns. And she was just like, I cannot give you any permission to do this. I was able to attend because I asked the AUS president to make it hybrid. But yeah, that's been the extent of my communication. I haven't, like, tried to file any, or, like, I imagine I will file a grievance in, like, the correct channel in the future, but I haven't really talked to them about it. Also because, like I said, Dean Shapiro doesn't seem like the correct person to ask about this. She doesn't have all the information about these exclusion orders either.
Yeah, I'm going to read from a brief that the Legal Information Clinic at McGill put out today. So they're talking about how these orders are interim orders, right? They say, quote, interim orders are supposed to be exceptional measures because they grant extraordinary powers to the disciplinary officer. And later on, what they say is the interim nature is important to highlight because a student facing an interim order cannot contest the basis of an order. The effective non-availability of appeal imposes a higher burden on the issuing authority to demonstrate that the rights infringing order is justified. While students can contest the reasoning behind interim orders through informal dispute resolution or by filing a student grievance, the immediate nature of the orders often means that students have no procedural recourse in the moment. What they're saying is that these are extraordinary.
Yeah.
That's clear. And that when you get them, you can sort of do exactly what you've been doing, which is send a bunch of emails and say, what are my rights here? Mm-hmm. Find some kind of accommodation. Later, you can file a grievance, but there's not, like, a quick and easy appeal. I guess, how has that impacted you on campus, in your life, just in general?
Yeah, well, I mean, because when they first gave me the exclusion order, they didn't say what it meant. Like, in the order itself, it doesn't say that I can attend academic activities. So I, like, emailed them, and I didn't get an email back until, like, later night on Monday. So I did miss some classes on Monday, which is ultimately fine. One of them, attendance was mandatory, and I had to, like, email my professor about it, and this is a professor that had been very upset with the student protest, and I felt a little bit uncomfortable, like, admitting that I was one of those picketers, and I was a little bit worried that he would ignore me and would punish me for missing. He ended up emailing me back, which was nice. I don't know, it also just sucks that it's exam season and I can't study in the libraries. Yeah, but I mean, besides that, I can go to class. I also just feel very uncomfortable on campus now. I mean, security guards know who I am and they know my name. And I actually had, like, when I was not picketing anymore because I'd been banned, I gave my friend some sunglasses that I had been using to cover my face with during the week, and she wore them to go picket, and the security guards were coming up to her and calling her by my name and, like, kind of taunting her with it, which just makes me, like, really uncomfortable. And the idea of, like, maybe seeing these men on campus that were, like, pushing me and touching me and grabbing my friends and then, like, calling me by my name, it just, I don't really feel safe myself anymore. I mean, not that I think they're going to, like, taunt me now, but, and I'm not going to come on campus besides classes. But it genuinely just does make me uncomfortable. And then also for Mittenmeier to tell me that he will now alert security every time I'm on campus, like, I don't feel safer knowing that and knowing that security know me, like, so well now. Yeah.
And what is the reaction from students been, like, at this AUS meeting mm-hmm. or in general? Because I've heard very different things, right? I've heard people say it is so weird to have this security presence, even if we don't like the protests and want to go to our classes, like, that the increase in securitization of campus is alarming. But I've also heard people say sort of, it's crazy that it's gotten this bad where there's these clashes in the classroom. You know, I wish these picketers would just leave, and I don't really care what happens to them, whether it's procedural fairness or not. I mean, I'm sure a lot of your peer group is, like, people who share your values and mm-hmm. your concerns, but do you have a sense of, more broadly, how this has resonated on campus?
Yeah, I mean, I can speak to the AUS presidents because of the roundtable I attended the other day, and, you know, ideally they represent their membership and their grievances. They, when Dean Shapiro opened up the floor to ask what questions or concerns people had from the strike week, everybody was bringing up the issue of security and stating how uncomfortable they felt with it, and not even being picketers themselves, but just saying, you know, so much of my membership is saying that security guards were coming into classes and kids and, like, sorry, students also don't really want to witness like somebody be carried out or, like, shoved up against a wall to the point that they can't breathe by, like, security guards that are supposed to protect us all on campus right before they go into their lecture. So that was the main concern of all the AUS presidents from the roundtable that I could gather regarding last week's strike was security presence and security's use of force and violence on students. And also they raised the point that security was not listening to professors, which made them feel even more unsafe because they weren't sure, like, whose orders these security guards were following. I had one professor who specifically asked them, the surveillance people, to stop filming their class. Because the thing is, they're not just filming the picketers, they're filming everybody. And they wouldn't listen to this professor. They said, like, no, they have the right to film all your students and yourself. Lots of professors asked us to, like, give their class announcements, and security wouldn't let us. I really can't speak to, like, the whole student body, but the presidents in the arts seem to be most concerned about security, not about these pickets. When I was picketing, the voices that I was hearing were the students that were largely against us because they were going to class during a strike. So, of course, I, like, didn't hear the people that were supporting us because they weren't in class. But, yeah, that's, I mean, and then there's other stuff on both sides. Of course, I was one of the people picketing, so it's obvious how I feel, but there was also, like, some people that were posting videos of us online getting very mad, and comment sections were like, deport these people. Like, I remember there's one comment that was like, this is why baseball bats should be handed out in class. So there's a wide range of feelings, I think, right now.
From the university side, I guess, what are the next steps? Because as you said, in this experience, you learned that McGill personnel are filming students. You maybe have questions about how they identified you. And now you also have this order, which, I mean, it didn't exclude you from attending classes, but you've said it affected you. According to the Legal Information Clinic at McGill, the first proposed revisions to the code in September removed the ability of a student like you to enter university premises for reasons permitted by the Dean of Students. So at an earlier point, some people who were involved with that amendment process were trying to get your ability basically to come to class and come to exams, like, totally struck.
Mm, okay.
So it's, yeah.
Yeah.
So it seems like, you know, there's an amping up from McGill, as maybe protests on campus have continued or increased, there's an amping up from McGill of the kind of measures they're willing to take in response to that. As a student who's affected by this, but also a student protester, like, what comes next?
Yeah, I mean, that's been, like, the big question since the strike work. I think everybody's trying to rest, but also trying to, like, reevaluate how we're going to go about this from here. I think there needs to be a lot of just, like, learning and information collection, like, to figure out our rights with this new student code of conduct. Grievances need to be filed, like, access to information requests. We're going to file a bunch of those to figure out who is recording us, because also there's a part of the student code of conduct that says, let's see if I can find it, essentially McGill cannot give student identities to third parties unless, like, we've explicitly broken the law. And so if indeed Serco is the ones filming us, then it says it's the part about access to personal information. It says no personal.
What section?
It's 42.42.
I have 42 debts due and monies paid to the university.
Okay, so this, I need to check, because this was, I was looking into this before the strike week, and at this point the new code was not out, even though it had been passed, and so I wasn't sure under what code we were operating at this point.
Okay, so we found it. It's in the Charter of Student Rights, not the Code of Conduct. Yeah, no personal information shall be disclosed by the university to a third party in a manner which permits the identification of the student unless such disclosure is required by law or unless you've consented to it.
Yeah.
In this case, we'd have to find out if that's required by law. But it doesn't initially seem obvious that it would be.
And so what we need to figure out how they identified us. Like I said, filing a bunch of access to information requests. There's also ways you can file, like, information specific to yourself, like within the McGill system. So collecting information to figure out how, like, going forward, if we want to continue striking at McGill and continue just protesting in general, how we keep ourselves and each other safe. And then, I don't know, there's bigger picture planning that needs to take place, because we've been asking for these same demands since 2023 and the university is not listening to our demands. So it's also like, to get, when McGill divested from South African apartheid and it took 5 years to get that, the 2012 strikes also had a big buildup, not as quite as much, but when they did that, it was an indefinite strike, which I think would be like the best course of action, but the McGill student body is not there yet. So just I think a lot of, like, evaluating where we go next. The Nova Scotia students, a lot of their universities are, like, building up over a year to just to a week-long strike. And I'm from Nova Scotia, and I'm planning on talking to some students there when I go back home in the winter, just because I think there's a lot of value to, like, even though it would be the same length as ours, building up creates so much more awareness, and maybe the impact will be a lot bigger. So I'm interested to see how they're approaching that. But yeah, I think that it's really a time for a lot of reevaluating how we're going to achieve our demands. Yeah.
Yeah. And I know we have talked about it, so I don't want to belabor the point, but, you know, something similar happened at Concordia, where somebody who's involved in, works in student government, got a ban from campus for handing out masks to picketers, protesters at an October 7th rally. I read media coverage of that, not campus media, like actual, like, National Post media coverage of that. And the tone, I think, by some people on campus, but also a lot of people off campus, is like, well, it's mayhem there and the universities are just doing what they do. Obviously, that's not everybody, but there is a subset of the population that just seems supportive of these extraordinary measures. Mm-hmm. And for anybody who's listening who's not a McGill student, right, who isn't here day to day and actually seeing how the campus is functioning, like, what's your message to people who don't have that context and are just seeing these videos that get shared on social media and thinking, like, yeah, maybe these students were constituting a threat?
Yeah, I mean, I would say, like, I don't know, I know a lot of these students. Most of us are, like, a lot of young women or just, I don't know, young people that literally could not be a threat to, like, a 40-year-old man whose job is to, like, train to, like, enforce and stop protests. I had a friend that was at the Concordia pickets and was picked up and thrown downstairs. He's a very small man. And I just think there's a lack of awareness of how uneven the power relation is. And I think that people also don't understand what our goal is. Like, we're not trying to be threats. We're trying to build awareness. And we don't want to fight anybody. And, like, it's never, like, students fighting each other. It's security guards trying to repress our voices and repress us from reaching our other students. And we're also not trying to hurt professors. And I'd also just, like, ask that you look at history and, like, understand that, like, some disruption is going to need to occur because our university has no incentive in itself to divest from genocide. Like, it's all of its board of governors are asking for these investments. Like, the Sylvan Adams building that's being built on campus right now, which I think is one of the largest donations for building that McGill has ever gotten, is from Sylvan Adams, a man who calls himself, like, the self-appointed ambassador to Israel and who has asked specifically for extreme repression of these protesters. So we need to disrupt in order for our demands to be met. And that doesn't mean we need to be violent. But unfortunately, like, with the state of security, they are enacting violence upon us. And I just ask that you look at it critically. I mean, like, we know that security is, this is what they've always done to protesters.
Susie, thanks so much for coming on CKUT. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
That was McGill student Cecilia Callahan speaking with me last Thursday about a 15-day ban from campus imposed during the recent student strikes for Palestine. Before that interview, I reached out to McGill for comment. I asked questions about whether they knew and allowed security personnel to go around filming students unidentified. I asked whether they used facial recognition to identify protesters, how they met the high bar in the code of disciplinary conduct that's needed to ban students from campus, as well as why they chose the full 15 working days for these bans when the strike was only a week long. Here's the response I got in full, and I quote, "We do not provide comment on individual cases. The only thing we will say at this time is that McGill is firmly committed to freedom of expression and peaceful protest while ensuring the safety of all members of our community and protecting students' learning rights. When groups choose to protest, university security personnel are present to remind participants that vandalism, violence, and classroom obstruction are not tolerated, and that compliance with the code of student conduct and disciplinary procedures is required to avoid sanctions." You may recall that at previous October 7th demonstrations, including the student strike, McGill has tried to ban protest on campus entirely. This past October 7th, they tried to get an injunction, stop the student strike, stop the protests, and for the first time, they failed. This may be the university's response. CKUT will follow this story as it develops.